In the coming months, let's see where else we can make progress together. Let's make this a year of action. That's what most Americans want. For all of us in this chamber to focus on their lives, their hopes, their aspirations.
President Obama there sharing his priorities for the new year last night in his sixth State of the Union address. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Among the president's goals last night, narrowing the country's income gap, in part by raising the minimum wage for federal contract employees, immigration reform, and an expansion of employee retirement saving plans. For his take on the State of the Union, I spoke early this morning with Republican Congressman Mike Rogers, who represents Lansing and East Lansing at the Capitol. I first asked him his general impressions of the president's speech.
Well, I was. There were some highlights. I thought recognizing the Army Ranger for his service and his sacrifice. He's going to have a lifetime of recovery. I thought that was pretty fantastic. Other than that, it didn't seem to have a lot of meat in the speech. I was a little disappointed, knowing all of the challenges we have in the economy, getting people back to work, growing the economy. I was hoping for a bit more there.
Republicans had multiple responses this year. Senator Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul of Kentucky. Which ones did you watch?
Well, I watched the Republican response with Kathy McMorris Rogers, who is a talented leader in our Republican Party and conference. She's the highest elected leader in the House, a woman in the House. And so she's I thought, offered the right message. So she has a disabled child and was, I thought, was extremely good at bringing it all together about what the challenges are and how we have to work together to move forward. That was the only one in my mind that counted last night. It was the only clear message in counter to what the president really didn't say in his speech, and I thought she did an exceptionally good job.
Various times, President Obama alluded to executive orders and his willingness to pursue that route. Do you expect the president will make more news this year working with Congress or by executive orders?
Well, if he works with Congress, that would be big news, and that's very unfortunate. You know, the president, I mean, it's well documented, does not have a great relationship with members of both the Senate or the House, hasn't really reached out to develop those relationships that you need to do. Our constitutional framework is that the Congress as a whole is a separate but equal body, and that's that temperament control that you want moving forward in government. So if he tries to exceed his authority, I think Americans are not going to be well received to that. If he reaches out and tries to work with Congress, this was a new day for that. I didn't hear that call. I heard, if I don't get what I want, I'll do what I want. That really is just more of what we've seen in the last 5 years and has caused serious disagreements in both parties, by the way, with the president's relationship with Congress. That's just not healthy moving forward.
The president urged that we close Guantanamo this year. Let's listen to that.
With the Afghan war ending, this needs to be the year Congress lifts the remaining restrictions on detainee transfers and we close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Because we counter terrorism not just through intelligence and military actions, but by remaining true to our constitutional ideals and setting an example for the rest of the world.
What do you make of that proposal?
Well, the problem is the president hasn't outlined any good alternative. So you can't have, airstrike as part of your policy and no opportunity for grabbing people and interviewing them versus killing them. And that's been our argument all along. We understand you want to do that, but what is your alternative? There is none. And releasing these individuals who we know have a very high recidivist rate, who go back and turn right back around, these are hardened terrorists, and get right back into the fight to try to take American lives or our allies' fights, is just not a good answer. It's good rhetoric, but it's just not reality. And if it were that easy, the president's been there for 5 years. He could have come up with a different alternative. He didn't do that. So again, that was one of those issues designed to divide people, and that's what I found disappointing in his speech. Lots of those divisive moments, not much of, hey, can't we work together on this or that? to better the lives of Americans.
What alternative would you propose with regard to Guantanamo?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things we need to do is when you look around the world, Al-Qaeda has actually broken into prisons to get people out, in the most recent in Iraq, but there is lots of examples around the world where they've broken in. So you've got a prison that you need to build that can hold them, that can be safe for military tribunal, that is isolated, makes it very difficult for Al-Qaeda in any numbers to show up to try to break in. And, you know, you ought to spend a couple $100 million on it. Well, the good news is we've done that, and we have that prison, and it's called Guantanamo Bay. I just think we've got to get over this. They keep saying the public perception. Well, bring in the Red Cross, which they've done, but let the rest of the world see these conditions. Those conditions are better than far more of our state prisons right here in our own country. And there's some notion that this isn't the right way to do it. You're going to have to close it. You're going to have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get a facility not just to keep people from escaping, but keep people from breaking in. So, again, we've got to be sensible about how we move forward. Currently, what they do now is if they grab someone, they put them on a floating prison in the ocean until they read them their Miranda rights and bring them back to the United States, mostly New York. And I just, you know, me and I think many others who care about national security just don't think that's the right security posture for the United States, or it's the right treatment of those prisoners.
10 days ago, you shared your concern over the Sochi Olympics, claiming that Russia has not been cooperative, sharing important security information. Is that improving at all?
Well, there's two different components to this. One is their physical security footprint, which is good. So they're trying to lock that down the best they can, but you can't do it alone by guards, gates, and guns. You can make a big impact in an event like this that's short-term in nature. The problem is on the counterterrorism side, they still really haven't stepped up to the plate to be fully cooperative on sharing information from a counterterrorism perspective. And I just don't think that's the right posture to make sure that not just the athletes, I think the athletes are going to be fine. I'm worried about spectators.
Speaking of counterterrorism, where is the discussion right now over the NSA and NSA reform?
Well, we're working through a variety of different proposals, mostly for transparency. The good news is nobody has found that the program had any abuses in the phone records program, zero abuses in that particular program, and that it was overseen by the courts. There's 17 judges, 37, I think, different opinions on its legality. And so I think that took that issue off the table. This wasn't a rogue agency doing something that wasn't well-informed with the other branches of government, didn't have lots of oversight. So now we just have to find that right medium of, well, what is the right level of transparency that people believe that their information is safe? And again, the other problem we've had is people still believe it's a program that records phone calls, which it does not, or records emails for them to read, which it does not. Both of those things don't happen. There's not even your name or your address in the database. So it's been used very sparingly 288 times to try to detect terrorists calling from overseas into the United States. That's an important tool. You know, we're struggling on the education front to get people to fully understand exactly what it does. We spend most of the time telling you what it doesn't do because of all the misinformation on the program.
And one last question. On a scale of 1 to 10, how likely that the GOP will take back the Senate in November?
I think probably 8.5. The Democrats have woefully, and I think the president did it again last night, don't understand what the health care law is actually doing to people who had health care through their employers. It's destroying that system, and that's why there's so many cancellation notices and people having difficulty finding it. And when they do, if they're fortunate enough to go back and find that health care, it is far more expensive than what they had before, and they get less coverage. And so that is such a personal thing. So you can say it's working fine. You can say, yeah, but look at our number here. 3 million people have now signed up, and you had this many people that didn't. That doesn't matter when it's your own pocketbook impacting your own family, and these businesses are having a horrific time trying to work their way through it. I think that that will be the single largest motivator for voters going into these the midterm elections, and I think we take back the Senate because of it.
Congressman Mike Rogers, many thanks.
Hey, thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. A longtime Michigan political insider is launching a bipartisan effort to bolster resources for state legislators. The Strengthening Michigan's Governing Institutions Project is the brainchild of Republican operative and attorney Richard McClellan, who maintains that term limits and years of shrinking funds have left legislators with too few resources to do their jobs well. Mr. McClellan announced the 501c3 initiative last week. His group hopes to raise $500,000 annually through foundations, associations, and corporations. And to learn more about the effort, Current State welcomes two guests. First, Richard McClellan, welcome back.
Good morning, Mark.
And we're also pleased to be rejoined by Lansing State Rep. Andy Shore, who is one of four representatives who have agreed to advise the group. Hi, Andy.
Good morning.
Richard, you say this effort is triggered by the combined efforts of term limits and shrinking shrinking government budgets. You call the state legislature dysfunctional as a result. Describe the kinds of dysfunction that you see.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, to make sure you have a problem that you need to fix. One of the most important things that the legislature does is the lawmaking. Drafting laws is really the critical function of the law, of the legislature. It's a very technical skill. The Legislative Service Bureau, the drafting function has been substantially reduced with retirements, budget cuts. Secondly, you have to understand the policy behind the bills you're drafting. And we've really lost a lot of the experienced policy people that help the legislators. And you combine that with term limits, where people are only in office for 8 years, 6 years. We have seen the underlying institution diminish. Let me just take one thing, and then I'll try to answer it this way. Think about the Michigan-Michigan State game at the Big House or Spartan Stadium. We go to watch the players do their job, but it's this huge underlying group of people that really make it work. We need that same thing in the legislature. We need the people at the staff level. We need organization. We need talent. We need skills. That's been diminished. And one of the points we also make, and I'll be quiet, is having the legislative leaders participate in some of these national organizations. We have not been doing that for the last several years, and it really is critical.
How legislatively, though, in terms of laws that are passed, do we see the result in, are there too few laws being passed, or are they too conceptually too weak or watered down or not researched well enough? Which of those two, or is it both?
I would say rather than the quantity, it is the quality. Technical skill in drafting, plain language so people know what they're doing, so departments know what to do, and dealing with some of the very complicated issues. That's where we have a real challenge now, is a big, complicated legal area, to have both legislators that know how to manage that large an area and quality staff, both partisan and nonpartisan. We're focusing on the nonpartisan technical staff, and that's where I think we're weakest.
Andy Shore, you're serving as one of four advisors to this project from the State House. How do you see your role here?
Well, you know, I've been in office for 12 months, but I've been in working with the legislature for, you know, 15 years. And there is definitely a difference now. It's much more different now than it was before term limits. You know, we're talking about technical expertise and things like that. Just yesterday, we passed a bill for the second time fixing a law that we passed previously this year. So we, you know, you go through and you go through all the work we have to do on a bill, and it passes into law, and we realize, oops, we forgot a piece, or there's something wrong with it, and we have to go back and fix it.
Does that happen often?
Twice I can think of this year. We did it with Court of Claims, and we had a fireworks bill yesterday that we had passed. So I think it does happen more than it's happened in the past. Now, that's not to say, you know, legislators aren't doing their job. It's to say that you have somebody who didn't catch a piece of it until after it was signed into law, and now you got to go back and redo it. That's a result of having a nonpartisan staffer who didn't know the background, who hasn't been there as long. We've got reduced budgets. We can't pay people like we used to. We are losing our personal staff, our central staff, that's partisan, our nonpartisan staff. We're losing these folks to associations, to lobbyists, to outside the system, because we can't pay them like we used to. You know, I have a very limited budget in my office, so I can only pay my staff a limited amount. If they get better offers somewhere else, I tell them go take it, because I don't want to hold them back. Well, I'm losing experience, and we're seeing that throughout government. So this project that Richard started, that I'm happy to be a part of in a nonpartisan way, I think we can build that institution back up. If we're not going to change term limits, then we need to help strengthen the institution.
And Richard, you aim to fund this effort with foundation, association, and corporate money. Are the people you're approaching or will be approaching for help, are they already aware of these negative impacts, or are you on some kind of awareness-raising campaign as well?
I think the closer you are to Lansing and the more you're involved, the more you know you see the problem. But I think there is going to have to be some explaining. And one of the things we want to start to do is have some of the, say, philanthropies understand that what happens in Lansing, the quality of legislation, can affect the impact of some of their philanthropic work. If we do a better job drawing the laws, we may be able to have more of an impact. So some of it will be selling, but the people who've been around Lansing pretty generally have seen the erosion.
Let's assume you reach your goal, raising $500,000 annually for some number of years. Tell us about what would you do with the first $500,000 that you come into? What would you propose?
First $500,000, at least part of it, my task would be to get some people to look at the legislative drafting function in other states and what is the most modern, effective way to do lawmaking. The fundamental job of the legislature. Let's make it technologically sophisticated, substantively well-organized, help the legislators in a term-limited environment. And it's very different than it would have been, say, 15 years ago.
Richard, you've vigorously backed libertarian conservative causes for many years. You were a major part of the secretive Skunk Works project last spring. You run a dark money campaign organization. I have to ask, why should people believe that you have this interest in bipartisanship?
Well, I don't think some people will. My experience has been that those people who know me, I've been around 45 years in the legislature. When the Democrats are in control, when the Republicans are in control, I was special counsel to the Democrat Appropriations Committee chair in the House. So my real experience is much more bipartisan than the kind of press clippings that you can identify. On the other hand, I was very much involved in the indigent reform legislation. I'm involved in leading the effort for reviewing criminal sentencing guidelines. So I'm not all right-wing conservative, but I am libertarian. So I tend to have a lot of allies in the more progressive side of the room if you're talking about liberty issues.
Okay. Are you concerned that if you generate more funding from groups on one side of the political aisle, that that could jeopardize your bipartisan intent here?
Yes. Yes, there's no question. If this were seen as some sort of a front group for, I won't name their names, but you know them, that would be my political friends, no, we wouldn't have any credibility. We are not going to do that. It just would lose credibility, and Andy Shore said it directly to me. If this were perceived at all partisan, he's out of there, and that's the end of that project. So we have a discipline that I want to maintain. A good example is the Michigan Political Leadership Program at Michigan State University. Been around for years, and it's always very, very well balanced, even though the participants are all partisans.
You know, it's funny. It's the same question that you ask. I've gotten asked quite a bit over the last, you know, few days. And Richard and I have our healthy disagreements on several issues. But the one thing you learn in Lansing real quick is you have to work. You work against people sometimes, and sometimes you work with those same people. And we may disagree on issues, and a lot of things you just mentioned that he's involved with, I don't agree with. But when he comes to me and says, I want to strengthen the institution, I'm on board. And when he says to me, we're going to make this transparent. Anybody that gives money, we're going to put that out to the public. It's going to be transparent. I'm on board. Until I see that, if I were to see this is some conservative right-wing conspiracy to affect government, then I'm gone, and so is Representative Kinesic and any of the other Democrats, and then it has no credibility and it falls on its own weight. So that's, I'm involved because I do think we need to strengthen the institution, and I take Richard at his word. And if it didn't happen that way, then you'd be the first to know, Mark. You and your listeners would be the first to know, and we'd be having a different conversation. So I look forward to this moving forward in a bipartisan way. Again, we can disagree on issues at the same time, but we can agree that we need to strengthen the institution of Michigan's government. So that's why I'm looking forward to this. And I'm definitely sensitive to what people say is working with that McClellan guy. Well, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt here. And if it changes, then you'll know about it first. But I'm looking forward to it.
We're talking with State Rep. Andy Shore and Attorney Richard McClellan about the Strengthening Michigan's Governing Institutions Project, which has just been announced. When all is said and done, are term limits worth it? Richard?
I voted against term limits. I don't think they're good government, but they're a choice that the public has made, and I think they're not going to change it. So my goal in this project is to make the legislature work within a term-limited environment. If we can round up the votes to change term limits, I'd be for that too. But I'm not counting on it, and I'm counting on focusing on however long people are in. I want them to do a good job. If they're only there a year, like Andy Shore, he's only been there a year. He should be able to, and I think because he had a good background, he was able to probably be more effective in his first year than some people. So training people, giving them the skills, giving them the staff support, regardless of term limits or not, is my goal.
Are you basically in agreement with Richard on term limits?
More or less. You know, I put in a constitutional amendment to extend term limits. I understand why people voted for term limits, why they put that in. I think they're too short. You know, the most common thing I heard when I ran for election was, you're running against Joan Bower. And I had to say, no, I'm not running against Joan Bower. She's term limited. And people were stunned. What do you mean she's term limited? She's only been there a short time. Well, she had been there for 6 years. I put in a constitutional amendment that would double it, that would give reps 12 years. It would give senators 24 years. I believe in that. But where I agree with Richard here especially is I don't think that's going to get a vote. I don't think it'll go to the ballot. I think if it went to the ballot, we would see a different result now than we did 20 years ago when term limits passed. I think people are ready for an extension because they see some of the problems in government are because of term limits. But we won't have a chance to see that because the speaker has indicated that he's not going to take up my resolution. It's not going to come up. So we have to work within the system. But I'd love to see term limits back on the ballot with an extension so people have more time to become experienced and to use that experience for bettering Michigan.
Richard, when you talk about term limits with other Republicans, how do they explain their opposition?
Well, I think many Republicans have buyer's remorse that supported term limits when it was first
really?
On the ballot. Talk to former Governor Engler, and I think you'll get that reaction. That was a proposal that came along at a period of time. There's always a tendency to think that some silver bullet will fix everything. The latest obsession is part-time legislature. There'd probably be nothing worse than to combine part-time with term limits, and then you would really guarantee an ineffective legislative branch. So I think term limits, one of the biggest dangers is too many people want to change term limits so they don't focus on other kinds of things that can be done in a term limited environment. And that's where we're different. We want to fix and improve the quality of legislators however long they're in office and not waste a lot of energy on the term limits issue. Now, here, we've taken up a couple, 3 minutes on that issue just this morning, and that's the tendency sometimes of these conversations to lurch off into, just like when they passed term limits, everybody thought it would solve everything. Now there's a tendency to say, if we get rid of it, it'll fix everything. No, we've got a lot of other problems to address, whether or not we have term limits.
Richard, the governor's taken some heat for signing a campaign finance measure that preserves the anonymity of contributors to some campaigns. You, on the other hand, support the governor's move. Explain why.
Well, I really been since high school a sort of First Amendment person, and I have seen been involved ever since the first campaign laws passed. I did the first ethics commission for Governor Milliken way back. But I've come to understand that there is a distinction, and the law distinguishes between political expenditures and issue advocacy that has a political impact. And it's largely a technical fight over what should be disclosed and what should not. Yes, I am in favor of what is called dark money in certain circumstances. General, if you're going to give money to a candidate, you should disclose it. But if you're going to be involved in broad public policy discussions, disclosing your having to turn over all your membership records to the government and to the media is not something that I'm in favor of.
On Saturday, Andy Shorey, we want to make mention of an event that you were involved in. Get Covered America will be joining you, or you'll be joining them, I forget which it is, at a special Lansing Health Coverage Education and Enrollment Fair.
Yeah, I'm working with the Juneteenth Committee and Get Covered America. We're doing a Passport to Better Health this Saturday from 11 to 3. It's at Mask Memorial Church on 5601 South Waverly. I think it's going to be a great event for people to learn about health care and getting covered, so I hope folks will show up.
Okay, we wanted to make mention of that.
Thanks.
We got a little bit more time here, though. Richard, can you talk to us about who you'll be approaching, who you're talking with about support for this strengthening governing institution?
Yeah, I think without wanting to name names of people we're going to be calling, if you look at the kind of public support for the legislature, historically it's some of the large corporations have always participated with loaned executive programs. They support the kinds of effort we have. So there's a lot of that. Plus the philanthropic groups in the state give away $1 billion a year. And we're going to definitely try to suggest to some of them that we could be, they could, particularly longer-term funding, so philanthropy, wealthy individuals, and the corporate community, and the labor community.
How often, Andy, will you be participating in gatherings here associated with this?
As often as I can, as often as I can, within my schedule. I know a variety of folks are getting together tomorrow morning, just to talk about it as an advisory committee to meet with Richard and to chat about some of the options. I actually can't even make that, but I'm going to sit with some of them afterwards to chat. I'd like to be helpful as an advisor. I don't know if I'm going to be part of the day-to-day, but wherever I can be helpful. I don't want to, as an advisor, you don't want to be part of the making the sausage necessarily, but I'm happy to.
You're involved enough in that.
That's right. But I'm happy to talk to people, and if, on my side, let them know that it makes sense to put in some money for this, wherever I can be useful.
And are there more than the four state reps that I alluded to earlier involved? I assume there's a senator or
Mark,
two?
Mark, we're going to, I'm going to have two meetings tomorrow. One of them is to show the House advisors this list of really extensive list of former legislators, community leaders, and others that we can broaden this advisory board. So we're going to be trying to make that selection as soon as I get back from Antarctica.
And you leave for Antarctica on Friday?
Friday.
Okay. Going to go warm up down on the southern end of the globe. We've been talking about the Strengthening Michigan's Governing Institutions Project with its originator, Richard McClellan, also State Rep Andy Shore, who is one of four representatives agreeing to advise the group. Thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. It is Wednesday, which means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature two organizations that assist victims of sexual assault in the area. Sherry Murgatroyd is the program coordinator for the MSU Sexual Assault Program, and Beth De La Osa is the coordinator of Sparrow's Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program. Welcome to both of you to Current State.
Thank you.
Sherry, what services do you offer here at MSU exactly?
Well, the MSU Sexual Assault Program has a 24-hour sexual assault crisis line. We have in-person crisis intervention services and medical advocacy services at Sparrow Hospital, where we work very closely with the Sparrow Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Unit there. So we have advocates on call to go to the hospital and meet with a victim after they've been assaulted and when they present there for forensic evidence collection. And
is this with MSU students who are victims? Only or
no,
others?
No, the entire community. We have about 100 volunteers that help provide crisis line services and our in-person medical advocacy services at Sparrow Hospital. We also do legal advocacy through the criminal justice system.
Hmm. And Beth, what services do you provide at the Sparrow program?
We our facility is or our program is located within the emergency department at Sparrow, in which we have six registered nurses who provide the care to anybody that presents, either through the emergency department or through Sherry Services, law enforcement. With a concern of being sexually assaulted, and we provide them the services of a advanced nursing assessment according to their history that they present with as far as their assault, and mm-hmm. we do a very detailed head-to-toe exam, physical exam, detailed genital exam if there's any kind of injury. We provide them with prevention medications for infections that they could have possibly encountered mm-hmm. due to their assault, prevention for pregnancy. Another great thing that we do is we coordinate care with Sherry's team, coordinate care with law enforcement, protective services. We do provide care to men, women, children, all ages.
How long has that program been active at Sparrow?
We've been since, Sherry can probably help me with this, I'm a greater than 10, 15 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. How would both of you characterize sexual assault rates in this area? Sherry, have you seen an uptick or a decline here at MSU? What's the pattern?
I have not seen an increase or decrease. You know, generally speaking, I think nationally, you know, the rates are 1 in 5 women or 1 in 4 women will experience sexual assault in their lifetime, and 1 in 6, you know, men will experience sexual assault as boys. So, you know, what we see at MSU or in the Ingham County area, the Greater Lansing area, is right on with, you know, what other national rates are according to the Department of Justice. I like to use those stats. So it is quite prevalent. Sexual assault is prevalent, and I think we have a great response, you know,
Beth,
effort here.
Beth, from your perspective, is it going up gradually, going down gradually? Is,
you know,
it just steady, like Sherry suggests?
Right. It's real hard because not everybody reports. It is kind of triumphant when a patient does select to report and come in for services. Our program at Sparrow, we last year in 2013 just saw just under 380 patients in 2013. And so far this year, in the month of January, we've had a patient report almost every day. We're near 30 patients at this current time.
And of the patients who report, how many don't report? Is much known about that?
Yes, the Department of Justice stats actually reflect that about 20% of rape victims report to the police.
Ooh.
So the majority do not report. So that's, you know, what we like to see is an increase in reporting, because we know a lot of people do not talk about this issue.
What do we do about that?
The increase in reporting?
Yeah.
Wonderful shows like this. You know, it's really about promoting awareness and services, support groups and therapy services we have on campus, and community resources,
right,
that we have a response team.
We have a chance to come in any kind of forum, whether it's to a school or, you know, I've been out to certain functions out here on campus, just student groups that are interested in it. The more we talk about it, the more people are going to understand the services and the support that they'll receive if they do Indeed report.
What's the barrier? What do you think the primary barrier is?
A lot of barriers is that most sex offenders know their victims. And so when someone is assaulted by someone that they know, they're less likely to report to the police. And alcohol and drugs are quite often used in scenarios to make people vulnerable.
Okay.
And when alcohol and drugs are involved, I think it's that victims are less likely to come forward to for lots of reasons. They may be afraid that they're going to get a minor in possession or in trouble, you know, a ticket for using drugs or alcohol if they're underage. And they're also blaming themselves for, you know, that situation they're in. And that's a lot of work that we do is to tell people that it's not their fault if they're sexually assaulted. They were targeted. They were, you know, there was a scenario created where they were made vulnerable. So I think more education we can do to encourage people to come forward and report, the more we can hold perpetrators accountable in our community.
What do you feel, Beth, what do you think victims struggle with the most from your perspective?
I think a lot of what Sherry said, it's a huge decision to walk through our door to basically come out of their mouth and share, you know, I'm here because I was raped or I was sexually assaulted. Just acknowledging or coming to terms with them that they need that higher level of care, that specialized care that we offer is it's real hard. I guess I pick that up from a lot of patients.
I have to ask you what you make of Senator Whitmer's rather controversial disclosure on the floor of the Senate that she was a victim of sexual assault. Do disclosures like that help? Do they tend to increase the amount of reporting that goes on? Can you link those two together?
I think she certainly will be a role model for people who maybe have thought about coming forward to either receive services or to report to the police. She has served as a role model, and what we often see is delayed reporting. Most people don't report right away. They're very confused. Mm-hmm. They're torn, especially if it's from someone that they know. They may not want to get them in trouble. Mm-hmm. They may not want to be ostracized from the family or their social support system. So we've gotten a lot of feedback. Our program actually received a donation in the name of the senator, and a lot of students are talking about how brave she is. And she's, you know, impacting women's health.
Where does your funding come from?
Most of our funding comes from the Department of Justice, which is VOCA funds, Victim of Crime Act funding. They are administered by the Michigan Department of Community Health Crime Victim Services Commission. So we've been receiving that funding for about 27 years now, and it funds three of our staff members.
And speaking of funding, you've got a fundraising event this weekend, a production of The Vagina Monologues. Tell us about that.
The Vagina Monologues, it's a global effort, international effort from V-Day. It is a play written by Eve Ensler that really focuses on women's issues around sexuality, childbirth, love and joy. And it's primarily a comedy with some drama in there. It's life-changing. I really highly recommend people come support The Vagina Monologues. And this year, the beneficiary is the Sparrow Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Unit.
Oh.
So the more people we have coming out, the more we can help support Sparrow services that, that they provide the free service to our entire community.
If people want to get involved, Sherry, how do they do it? Do you need volunteers?
We are doing volunteer training right now. We always need volunteers. They can go to our website, which is endrape.msu.edu, and we have volunteer information there. We also have information for the Vagina Monologues, or they can go to the Wharton Center to purchase tickets there.
Very good. Sherry Murgatroyd is the program coordinator for the MSU Sexual Assault Program. Beth De La Osa is the coordinator of Sparrow's Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program. Thanks to both of you for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much.
You.
And a reminder that we could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We just need to find out about them. So help us out. Tweet us at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm tempted to say our next guest has written a self-help book for the ages. More accurately, it's a self-help book of the ages. Roman Karsnarik is a British teacher and philosopher whose latest book, How Should We Live?, looks at 12 of humanity's touchstones, like love, money, creativity, and time, and then explores what thinkers throughout history have written about those subjects. Roman Karsnarik is on the line from London. Roman, welcome to Current State.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
In your liner notes, you quote Goethe, who said, quote, "He who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living from hand to mouth." And you suggest you wrote this book because you think people overlook what the past has to teach us. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's interesting that if you walk down through your local bookstore and look at those books on self-help or personal development, most of them are based on ideas on psychology or philosophy or religious and spiritual thought, all pretty good ideas, of course. But what's really missing there is ideas based on history, about what we can learn from the past about everyday living. And I think it's a shame that we don't try and draw on ideas from the past, because of course people have always been struggling with the big questions we still struggle with today: how to make relationships work, how to deal with the, you know, our fears about death, or how to find fulfilling work.
Well, the future seems to be coming at us faster than ever before. Do you fear that we are becoming more detached from history in favor of the present or the future?
I certainly agree that everyday life is, in a way, is changing faster. The future is coming faster than ever before. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's something of a crisis in the art of living. Just think how we make friendships and fall in love now, a lot of it happening online. This is completely new. Or job satisfaction levels are at record lows today. 50% of people get divorced. We're living longer than ever before. You know, consumerism isn't delivering the happiness that people thought it would do. So all these things are a big mix that are making us rethink how to live our everyday lives today and try and find, you know, new solutions for personal well-being.
You open your book with a chapter on the various definitions of love through history: philia, which is a kind of a warm companionship; pragma, with an emphasis on devotion, often in the later years of a relationship; eros, with its emphasis on sex. What do you think a general reader stands to gain from thinking about this?
Well, you might think that, you know, here in the 21st century, the way that the ancient Greeks thought about love 3,000 years ago, it wouldn't be very relevant, but it surprisingly is. And if you think today that, you know, 94% of young Americans say that they're looking for a soulmate, a single romantic lover to embody all of their loving needs. We're looking for one person to be our sexual partner and to grow old with and have children with and so on. Now, the ancient Greeks were quite sophisticated in how they thought about love. They had these six different words for love, more sophisticated in the way we will whisper "I love you" over a romantic meal than sign an email the next morning, "lots of love." So they had these different words for love. As you mentioned, there's philia, which is about deep friendship, the opposite of a social network online friendship, something much deeper where you'd sacrifice for people; pragma, which was mature love; eros, as you said, sexual passion. They also had a word for selfless love, agape, and there was a word for self-love, a healthy kind of self-love, and then there was also a word for playful love, which was called ludus. And the Greeks' idea was that we need to cultivate all these varieties, tap into love's many sources with many kinds of people. And I think anybody who feels they're lacking a bit of love in their life, if they mapped out the six Greek loves, they realize that actually their love life isn't really too bad.
Hmm. In your chapter on nature, you open with a story from 100 years ago of a man named Joseph Knowles, who sought to confront nature head on by living like Adam in the Maine woods, very primitively, for a period of months. This urge to leave modernity, and especially to leave technology behind, seems to run steadily through history. In this high-tech age, do you consider losing touch with nature a growing challenge for civilization?
I think it certainly is. Anybody who has children, like I've got 5-year-old twins, you know, who would rather stay inside and play on the iPad than actually go and climb a tree. And I think that's symptomatic of the way we're becoming divorced from nature. And there's very interesting theories about how human beings are actually wired for connecting with nature. There's this concept of biophilia, the way that, you know, if you put two groups of hospital patients in different rooms, one group looking at a brick wall outside the window and the other group looking at trees and greenery, those who are looking at greenery will get better faster. You know, we are designed to connect with nature. So I think when we're thinking about the art of living, we've got to work out, well, how can we connect back with nature again? And I think one of the ways a lot of people are doing this is through promoting simple living, trying to step out of high-speed, high-caffeine urban lifestyles and get back a bit to how Joseph Knowles was trying to live or Thoreau was living in the 19th century in his log cabin in Walden Pond.
Which chapter in your book did you get most wrapped up in?
Well, the one that really did it for me was the chapter on family life, because it changed my views about how to be a parent. You know, when I was writing the book, my twins were about to be born, and I kind of assumed that in history, you know, it was mostly women who did the childcare, and, you know, today's super dads are kind of modern invention, those dads who can change diapers blindfolded and so on. But what I found out, to my astonishment, was that in pre-industrial America and Europe, fathers were much more hands-on than they are today, partly because the workplace was much more around the household. People were craft workers doing agricultural work. And so while women may have rocked the cradle, men often they made the cradle and cut the hay. And partly they were involved in childcare more because so many women died in childbirth. So writing and learning about that, that pre-industrial fathers, made me realize that I should join this proud tradition of hands-on dads and get a bit more involved in the childcare myself. And that's exactly what I tried to do.
We're talking with author Roman Karsnarik. His latest book is called How Should We Live? And it looks at what thinkers throughout history have written about 12 of humanity's touchstones: love, money, creativity, time, and a number of others. You alluded to modern self-help books a few minutes ago. Do you spend much time reading them or looking these over?
I try and read the classics, whether it's, you know, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, or, you know, books about feeling the fear and doing it anyway. But I think self-help is a much broader historical tradition than a lot of sort of just the modern self-help books, which tend to have a lot of psychology and a lot of bullet points in them. Some of them are great, but for 2,000 years, philosophers have always been trying to write self-help books. They've been involved in that question of how to live, whether it was Plato back with the ancient Greeks or Montaigne writing in France in the 16th century. Everyone's always been grappling with it. So I think I'd like to think that my book is trying to reinvent the self-help genre and inject a bit of that historical perspective into it. So, you know, I do try and read things, but keep my mind as broad as possible.
What do you make of the general popularity of these kinds of books today, though? Does their popularity reflect a healthy idealism, or is there something more desperate in play here?
It's a really interesting question. I think on the one hand, the problem with a lot of modern self-help books is they're too much focused on the individual, about how I can improve my life and really focus on my personal ambitions and desires. And what's missing there is connection with other people. For example, the role of empathy, the role that can play in making us feel bonded to others and to our communities, because that stuff really matters too, because we're wired to be empathic beings. We're wired for social cooperation. So I think the self-help books put a bit too much emphasis on the individual. But on the other hand, I think what's great about them is that they reflect a dissatisfaction with consumer lifestyle, really, that there's been a boom of self-help books since more and more people realize that as they get wealthier and they work harder to earn money and buy themselves a bigger car or a wider screen TV, those kind of consumer goods don't really add much to human happiness. And actually what matters more is, you know, finding work that offers you a vocation or having meaningful relationships or getting back to nature.
One of your goals, I read, is to establish an empathy museum. What objects would be in an empathy museum?
Well, an empathy museum is the opposite of a normal museum full of objects. An empathy museum would be full of conversations. So my idea is that it would be a place you could go in and have conversations with people from really different walks of life. You might walk in and have a conversation with a Quaker pacifist or an unhappy investment banker, maybe the kind of people you wouldn't meet, an ex-bistro owner, and you might have conversations about life using, for example, menus of conversation with questions on them, like, what have you learned about the different varieties of love in your life, or in what ways would you like to be more courageous? Because I think we need to create these spaces in society where we can have conversations with strangers, because that can really shake us up and see us help us see our lives in new ways. But I've started the Empathy Museum, a digital version recently. Actually, I have a new project online at a website called empathylibrary.com, where anybody in the world can go and find the best films or books all about empathy. It could be films like Avatar or books like Down and Out in Paris and London or Toni Morrison novels.
Now, you advocate what sounds like a related practice called outrospection, which I gather may be related to this involvement with empathy. Can you define outrospection for us and tell us why you consider that important?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, go back to the ancient Greeks again, and the philosopher Socrates said, you know, the way to live a wise life is to know thyself. And I think traditionally we've thought of knowing thyself as being about being introspection, about looking inside your soul and gazing at your own navel. And of course that matters for us. We have to think about how our childhood shaped us, for example, look inside ourselves. But I think we also need to discover who we are by stepping outside ourselves. And that's what I call outrospection. That's the idea of discovering who you are and how to live by discovering the lives of other people and the way that different civilizations have looked at the art of living. And I think empathy is the ultimate art form for the age of outrospection. It's a way of stepping outside yourself.
In researching your book, Roman, did you encounter historical values that simply don't have a place in the modern world?
That's a really fascinating question. I think when you look at history, look at the history of marriage, for example, go back four or five centuries, and people didn't really marry for love. You know, marriage was all about a financial agreement, really, between two different families.
Uh-huh.
It was about securing your family bloodline. It was only in the 17th century that people started marrying for love and thinking that their husband or wife or partner could become their best friend. So there's all sorts of things which don't really make sense to us so much today, that idea of marriage. But I think we can still be learning from the past at all times, that people really weren't so different today than they were, you know, three or four centuries ago. They are still struggling, as I said, with our everyday dilemmas of life.
You're associated with what's called the practical philosophy movement. What is that?
Well, I think for too long, philosophy has become an academic subject, really, which isn't really related to everyday life. I studied philosophy at Oxford University in England, a famous university, and I don't think anything I learned was much use of how to deal with problems with my kids or my relationship with my father or how to find a great job. And I think the modern practical philosophy movement is trying to say, well, how can a thoughtful approach to life and drawing on the wisdom of history actually help us with our everyday dilemmas? I mean, just think that, you know, 25% of people are stressed out constantly. Well, surely philosophy should be able to help us with that. And I think a lot of those scholarly philosophy books, though written by interesting, clever, and kind people, aren't necessarily easy to apply for how you and I think about our lives every day.
Roman Karsnarek is a British teacher, philosopher, and author whose latest is called How Should We Live? Roman, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me on the program.
Best of luck.
Okay, bye-bye.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow here on Current State, we'll review the top news stories of January with journalists Tim Skubick, Emily Lawler, and Bill Ballinger. We'll also look at the carbon footprint of musical instruments and tell you about a marimba made in Michigan. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR.